101, a version 1 podcast.
Welcome to the 101 podcast, conversations about technology and innovation with some of the UK and Ireland's leaders and trailblazers. My name's Peter Gothard, and today I'm joined by Mark Ridley, a person in technology whose job title alone could take up a whole podcast. CTO, digital innovation guru, startup accelerator expert, MIT boot camp coach. How should we define you, Mark?
That is a good question, it's one that I struggle to answer. So most of my career, pretty much all of my career, I've worn something close to the CTO title. So the person with responsibility for plugging things in businesses. So if it had a plug on, generally it was my responsibility. I spent 18 years at Reed.co.uk. So I was a tech co-founder at Reed, where I learned, had a fantastic training, fantastic, fertile environment to learn the ropes of technology.
So, and when you say tech co-founder of Reed.co.uk, do you mean when they went online?
Yeah,
you were there.
Exactly that. So, right. So back in 97, I started my career at Reed, actually developing web pages to start with, and went on to develop their search and build out the technical team and develop Reed.co.uk as a separate business to Reed. And then from there, started moving more into the innovation space. I had a brief stint with Accenture in Dublin building their innovation lab, and then took a role as group CTO of a venture builder based in London, where I looked after the portfolio of CTOs, often doing relationship counseling between CTOs and CEOs. That was an amazing experience to get into venture-backed scale-ups and startups. And since then, I have now started an advisory practice really aimed at CEOs and CTOs. So I would consider myself a CTO advisory practitioner, where I go into businesses and help them understand tech.
CTO whisperer.
CEO whisperer, more often. CTO is normally the easy part, and the CEO is the ones that I have to whisper.
Okay. So, I mean, we were talking the other day before we recorded this, and you kind of gave the impression that you help startups mature, and also you can maybe help mature companies to, I mean, this is my interpretation, almost become immature, to almost start to experiment more. Is that fair comment? And can you kind of elaborate on the way that you, when you go into places, like what sort of conversations you have, and how do you help people sort of become their best people?
So those things are definitely true, and there's probably a couple of ways to answer this. The first is that with the practice that I run, I try to balance the portfolio between scale-ups that are looking to become more mature and more mature businesses that are looking to become more agile and more nimble. And the inspiration for that really came from some of the work that I was doing at the end of my time with Reed, where I created Monday Labs, which was an internal incubator for our own ideas. And we took staff who were already in the business. We didn't provide venture capital. We took ideas that were seeded by our own employees and then created very small teams of around 4 or 5 employees, and then just stood them up with their idea and said, okay, have a go at it. And we noticed there was an order of magnitude improvement in the speed that those teams were delivering. So that they came out of a well-established team, and suddenly being 4 or 5 people completely committed to an outcome, they were incredibly productive. And that taught me a lot of lessons about how not stagnant we'd become, but how conservative and bureaucratic we had become, which is necessary as business scales. So I now try, when I'm not working directly with scale-ups, which keeps me in that environment, I try to work with corporates who want to replicate some of that really new proposition development. So it's where they are focused on value, on profitability, on very important metrics, but they're struggling maybe with a disruptive innovation. So how could we build a capability to bring new products or new propositions to market?
So essentially you're splitting people into smaller groups with more focus to look into new things. And does that tend to come, I don't know, on the fulcrum of wider trends in technology? So maybe they're looking to investigate a certain way of doing things, or just sometimes they have no ideas, and you'll have to go in and almost show them what they can be doing as well as how they can be doing it.
Actually, there's a really important point there, which is I don't think anybody ever struggles for ideas. People wrongly believe that ideas are valuable, whereas ideas really aren't valuable. It's the execution that is valuable. And often one of the things that I have to guard against is the highest paid person's opinion, which is you walk into a business, and this is especially true in larger organizations where you have successful executives who are successful and executives through merit. They've got to a position in the organization, and their ideas have generally been good and been successful. But what can happen is that the belief wrongly becomes that it's just a good idea and should be and can be executed. So a lot of what I try to do is to democratize that those ideas. Understand that just because you're a highly paid exec doesn't mean that your idea is necessarily better than anybody else in the organization. And put in a methodology and a process that allows ideas to be validated. So to go through a discovery process so that you can actually think about, how can I really tell if I'm going to make money from this? And often people are very unclear about what success looks like. What is the outcome you want? And in a business, you might wrongly think that you're just going to get millions of pounds in revenue, but won't have considered, can I sell it? Who is going to buy it? When are they going to buy it? What's the trigger? So actually, those small teams that we put together all those years ago at Reed, the biggest learning we had outside of small teams are highly effective, was that cross-functional teams are the most important thing you can put together. And actually bringing salespeople or marketing people into those conversations early is critical. So it's not just that there's a belief that you have a good idea, sort of a product owner, product manager idea, you put some techies behind it, so you put some developers or engineers behind it, and a mobile app will make you money. Whereas actually in that room, you need someone who is going to be on the hook for selling it. So salespeople are a critical part of that cross-functional team.
That's really interesting. I suppose something I was thinking about while you were saying that as well, how do companies feel, and what sort of advice can you give to people maybe thinking about this kind of thing? What about costing, and what about budget, and what about, you know, if a consultant walks in and says, well, we should do this and you know, put people into teams and nurture ideas, how do you help people to get the money in place to allow failure and allow experimentation and you know, yeah, what can you say to them to make that happen?
Something that has become increasingly apparent to me over the years, There's a law in technology called Conway's Law, which Melvin Conway seeded, I think, in the 60s, which suggested that organizations will develop code that looks like the organization. I've never quite been sure whether that's causative or just a correlation. But you can definitely see it being true. But I now believe that organizations start to resemble how they fund themselves. So if they fund in projects, they start to be quite siloed. If they fund capabilities, then they may be more cross-functional. And so I think that funding question that you ask is really, really significant. How do you fund something where you're incredibly uncertain? Yeah. So for most businesses, they will tend to be more conservative and fund things that they understand well. So it will be a product line extension. Can I add a feature? Can I do a cross-sell or an upsell? And it's relatively easy to build a business case where you're dealing with something like a new proposition. So real disruptive innovation where we need to launch something that is going to be the next generation of our business. Then you're asking a really different question. One of the things, and again, I say this to almost all of the companies that I work with, is at the beginning of any project, and that it doesn't matter whether that's an HR system rollout or it's developing a new product feature, at the beginning of a project, you have the highest uncertainty about the success or even the outcome of that. You know the least because you, at that point, haven't done anything to learn more about it. So the investment gating should go hand in hand with driving down that uncertainty to drive your learning, your organizational knowledge. So what I try to encourage people to do is think about a way that they will fund small and growing teams, right-sized, right-people teams that start with an idea. So a small cross-functional team might be two people for 2 days. It might be five people for 2 weeks. And these might lead into each other. So that discovery process is, what is the smallest team that I can responsibly put on to drive understanding about this idea? I've got this idea, I want to take it to market. Well, how do you test that you should take it to market? What is the next test? What's the next assumption that you're going to challenge? And what's the smallest amount of money that I can put behind it to drive the understanding? And then gate that investment in larger and larger chunks.
Right, yeah. Because I think one problem I've seen in the past is that there's one view at the beginning of like, well, we'll put as little in as possible and then that's it. And until we see success at the end, you're getting no more resources, no more money, no more anything. And then these things just curl up and die. And then the idea is blamed and never the process.
Yeah.
And then it's like, we're never going to do that again. And then you've probably lost something that could have been. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And one of the follow-ons to that is we hear a lot, and some of it is nonsense, about celebrating failure, because by definition, failure is bad, and we probably shouldn't celebrate it. But there is a real kernel of truth to that. And if we peel back the why should we celebrate failure, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to stand up an experiment. So you are trying to celebrate the successful running of the experiment and acknowledging the fact that disproving the hypothesis is a valid outcome. And actually, you should aim to be about 50% successful experiments and 50% unsuccessful. Because if you are always succeeding to prove the experiment that you've set up or the hypothesis that you're testing with an experiment, then you're not being brave enough. It's not a challenging enough, risky enough experiment. Mm. If you're failing all the time, there's probably a problem as well. So ideally, what you're aiming to do is take these gambles, make the appropriate bet at the appropriate time, but set up challenging hypotheses and allow the team to run through the process successfully. So if they get to the end and say, actually, we've taken your idea and we don't think it can ever go to market, we don't think you're ever going to make any money out of it, whatever the successful outcome is, You can celebrate with that team because they have succeeded in running the process and saving you lots of money.
Mm.
Because you're not chasing some highest paid person's opinion and building out a massive product and then letting it die painfully years later when finally funding is cut in some budget review later on. So it's definitely around allowing those teams involved in discovery to feel that they are successful even if the idea hasn't been.
Yeah, because as you say, they've followed a process and they've done what they've come in and they've done their job, essentially. Yeah,
exactly right.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. So, innovation labs.
Yeah,
you mentioned earlier on. What do they work? Did yours work, and do they work generally? And how can you talk about what does come out of them?
There are two questions there. Did ours work? And actually, the very simple answer to that is. It is in part it worked, but it didn't meet its outcomes. And actually, this probably goes back to the corporate innovation labs themselves, which is how do you really think about what success is? What type of innovation do you need? I think that was a massive learning for me when I was first going through this process, was how do you understand what the correct outcome for that is, depending on the people who are sponsoring this. There's a lot of evidence that innovation labs don't work. That if you just create an innovation lab, and I can give very clear examples of where they don't work. If you start a new innovation lab inside your business, it looks like the fun place. You've probably got people doing the day job, probably very talented engineers, product managers, across the gamut of all the roles in your organization. And as soon as you create an innovation lab, what can happen is, why do they get all the fun?
Yeah. How, why do they get the ball pool and the slide?
Yeah. So they have all the fun stuff and I have to fix bugs. How is that fair?
Yeah.
And that is one of the key things to avoid. So I think that just going in and saying, let's have an innovation lab is almost bound to fail. I think there are discipline steps that you need to follow in establishing a culture of innovation that sits outside of your normal activities. It is very, 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 very valuable to create an environment that lets smaller teams function in different ways than the large teams, because large, well-established products or services are going to require a different type of care and attention than very early stage ideas. So small teams work incredibly well.
Mm.
But the advice that I would give is, how do you think about defining what a successful outcome is for those teams?
It almost goes back to what you were saying just about the idea that not celebrating failure, but the fact that they failed while doing what they were supposed to do means it was a success. And it's almost like, if you create a culture where the innovation lab, I'm not going to say isn't as much fun, but feels genuinely like it's a job which has a job description and is a thing you go in and do, as opposed to just like, hey, we're letting you off the leash and you can do whatever you like for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people will become envious of that while also the people in it won't focus. So it's almost like, I guess you just brief people and say, okay, this is serious, you know, and this is genuinely a thing.
Yeah.
And just do the job we're telling you to do.
So
and it's still real, you know.
It is not enough to put a few people in a room with an idea, you need to drive that team. So high performance teams are made up of individuals that feel jointly accountable for an outcome. So you have to be very clear that they're on the hook for an outcome. And you have to be clear what that is. What does it look like? What am I asking of you? The other thing to remember is that constraints are incredibly important. That if you leave people in a white room, then often they will spend way too long exploring what all the possibilities of being in that white room are. Actually saying, no, I need you. So I am restricting the amount of time you have. I am restricting the amount of budget that you have. I'm restricting the target market that you have. So you can only produce something that targets our existing customers or not existing customers. But actually drawing up that list of constraints is really important. And when I was talking about the earlier lab that failed, the real cause of failure, the individual businesses actually turned out to be much more like venture-backed businesses, in as much as they would have required an exit to work. They had high market potential, but they weren't going to be profitable nearly fast enough for us to roll into our standard business. So the learning that we took was we had a discussion after about 18 months that we should have had on day one, which is, tell me what economic outcome you want from this. And it's vastly different. If you're a larger business, maybe it is entirely sufficient that all your innovation lab does cool stuff, because then you can talk about it and it's a marketing activity.
Yes. Oh, we talked about this actually.
And that is sufficient. You know, if it is okay to talk about the future of retail so that you can talk to customers more knowledgeably about the future of retail and you never drive a penny of revenue from it, that's fine. Mm. But if you're a business that is all about managing for cash, then if you want to think about a new proposition, you have to figure out, how am I going to make this work? Am I happy to exit this? Will I sell it to another company? Will I take external investment to grow it? So those questions, really commercial questions, determine the structure of the team.
Yeah. And I mean, in the perfect world, you could do a bit of both. And, you know, if you had a successful lab that was doing its job properly, but also was good and fun and great, you could have some marketing as well as actually achieving something. And then yay. I think something else I wanted to ask you, and, you know, not wishing to be sort of cheeky, but we talked about this idea of, you know, making an engineering lead think like a CTO. And I just wonder if we could explore that a bit further, because, you know, for me, it's like, well, what do they do? Do they just start wearing a tie, you know, or how do you actually influence that shift? Because that's a huge shift.
It's a massive shift, and it's something I particularly come across in scale-ups, that often you have a very dedicated group of founders, somebody potentially wearing a CTO title, but at least the principal technologist within that group, the main techie, is going to is probably wearing something close to the CTO title, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are a CTO. It doesn't mean that they have the capabilities. And what often happens is that people haven't had the difference between being the best engineer in the company and being the CTO. And it was a decision I was actually confronted with very early in my career. I'm very grateful to my manager at the time. Asked me, do you want to be a manager or a techie? And this was in the early 2000s.
Right.
And I had to look at what I was really good at. Am I really going to be a technologist, or am I going to know how to run technology teams? So I took the decision quite early and then sort of doubled down on that. But as a CTO of a scaled business, so say as you get to past 100 employees, past 150 employees, the CTO job is entirely different than it is as CTO of a smaller business. Suddenly, your main concerns are around risk and growth and commercials and partner selection. It's around pitching for investment, speaking to customers, developing a roadmap. Lots and lots and lots of concern about how you're growing your team. How do you find the next generation of engineers or product owners? How do you structure? What does your strategy look like? How does that integrate into the company strategy? So all of those things are generally outwards facing.
Yes.
There is very little in there that suits introverts. It actually is a role that, and as speaking as an introvert, there are elements of a CTO role that I find extremely challenging. And I have to come to terms with the fact that there is a persona that I have to put forward if I go to a board meeting to make a pitch. That's deeply, deeply uncomfortable to me. It's something that I learned over years to cope with. And I think it's the other important thing is, as a lead engineer in a scale up, there is probably nobody to mentor you. So potentially wearing the CTO title. The CEO of a startup is the worst person to mentor you in a journey to become a better CTO.
Yeah.
Because it's not something that they've ever experienced. They may not have even ever worked with any scaled CTOs. So it's a very difficult, nuanced time for young CTOs to evolve and understand if they really want to do the job and not feel that it's a failure. Too many people see the CTO role as a badge which demonstrates that they are the best at technology, whereas actually it's the opposite. It is a career change. It is not a step up. It is a step sideways. It's a completely different job.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I suppose there are going to be people who just simply aren't going to do that, but can continue to be extremely powerful by being, I'm trying to think of a title now, but, you know, I guess a chief engineer, whatever.
Principal architect.
And can still hold that founder persona,
yeah,
but stay technical and still have that level of insight, you know, and that's also fine. Well, that's about all we have time for today. Thank you all for listening. You have been listening to the 101 podcast. I have been Peter Gothard, and I have been speaking today to Mark Ridley. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Peter.
To find more editions of the 101 podcast, please visit www.version1.com/1-0-1. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.